From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from the two people running for state superintendent and learn what they hope to do if elected. Milwaukee Magazine is out with a new list of some of Milwaukee's best restaurants. We'll learn about some of them, including Sorella.
They have incredible entrees like Osso Buco. The pastas are fantastic. It's just an all-around really excellent restaurant, which I was happy to bring back to the list.
Plus, we'll explore some of Wisconsin's weirdest museums.
It's a very odd place. I mean, all these places are great because they're so unique. And like you say, Wisconsin is very rich with them, so I had no trouble finding stuff to write about.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Wisconsin voters will decide on April 1st who will be the state's superintendent of public instruction. Incumbent Jill Underly is facing a challenge from education consultant and former teacher Brittany Kinzer. Kinzer previously led the City Forward Collective, a nonprofit organization. Before that, she oversaw a public charter school network in Milwaukee. Kinzer joins WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel to share how she hopes to approach the job if elected.
What are your top priorities, maybe the top 3 to 5 if you're elected?
So my top one, and this is why I got in the race, is to restore our high standards. That'll be the first. Then making sure that we are refocusing on teaching reading, writing, and math so that all children can get a meaningful job, go to college, or master a trade. And then ensuring that the, you know, billions of dollars that's spent on education is getting into the classrooms and rewarding our great teachers and not making, you know, creating more bureaucracy. Also with the Department of Public Instruction, making sure that it's transparent, making it really easy for families, schools, school boards, school districts to find the information we need, making sure that it's predictable and responsive, and ensuring that it's innovative. So we have the best practices available for, again, for our schools, our parents, our school boards, you know, the community, and ensuring that 95% of children in the end, 95% of children are reading well enough so they can have a meaningful career or go to college. We know that it's possible.
When you say rewarding teachers, I assume that means increasing pay. Where do you anticipate finding money for any sort of benefits or increase the salaries for teachers in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I'm all about making sure that we modernize the funding formula. It is a very complex funding formula. So I have promised people throughout Wisconsin, as I have traveled across the state, making sure that we modernize it so that right now, so many taxpayers, like, they're taking the burden, right? And so making sure more of that goes on to the state. I'm not an expert in the funding formula, so we do need experts, but I will be an advocate and leader on that. I also believe that we need to have a higher reimbursement for special education. Right now, we're like around 30%. So for example, when I was running my elementary school our first year, we spent over $1 million on special education. And then we didn't get reimbursed until the next year. So we do need to have a higher reimbursement rate. I don't know what is possible for that. That would be conversations between the legislature, the governor's office. We have to find something. We have to work together. And that's something I can do, is work. I've shown that I can work with both sides of the aisle and the governor's office to get things done. So that higher reimbursement of special education, and then also which will help with more money in the budget, right? Also making sure that we have a higher reimbursement in the rural areas for transportation. And also just like helping school districts when they need it. Like, how are you spending your money, right? And how can you be creative in the way that you are? And I don't know if creative is the word, but being efficient and making sure that teachers are, you know, the money is getting into the classrooms and not on other things. But again, reimbursement and special ed, increasing that, rural transportation, and modernizing the funding formula.
Thank you. How are you going to balance the needs of public and private schools? DPI is obviously an institution that is tasked with regulatory oversight and licensing of public school teachers, but you've expressed some interest in parental options. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so DPI has to follow the law there, right? So I want to remind everyone, DPI is not the legislature. We don't make laws, but we do follow. We have to follow the laws. I want to ensure that all children are able, you know, 95% of our children are learning how to read. That is why I got into this race. When she lowered the standards, I thought that I was shocked, because it made it look like more kids are prepared, but that's not what's best for kids. We've got to be brutally honest about where they're at and ensure they're getting the reading instruction they need, the interventions that they need. So I see there are children here in Wisconsin. They are, you know, when we talk about the private schools, what is it? It's less than like 10% of children that are in, you know, using a scholarship, going to a private school. And many of those children are living in living in socioeconomically disadvantaged communities. And I would like to start talking about the families that are choosing to use that scholarship. This is not an object. It's not just this voucher thing. These are families in Milwaukee. And I specifically, when I'm thinking about the families, I'm thinking about the families I've worked with here in Milwaukee. We have almost 40,000 kids going to the private schools, or maybe it's 30,000. I might be down. The numbers might be a little different there, but, their families who are choosing to use that scholarship, they've had this choice for 30 years. And when you talk, like, we need to make sure we're talking with the families. Like, what do they, why are they choosing the scholarship program? Like, why aren't they going to the district? But getting back to it, like, I'm focused on, you know, majority of our families still are using the traditional public schools. That's what we use. That's what they choose for their child, like 800,000 kids. We got to focus on everyone. You know, the attack has been on me that, oh, you're also focusing on the private schools. Well, we have children that are in those schools, and we have children in public charter schools. We have children in the virtual schools. We have children homeschooled. I feel like I'm missing one. Oh yeah, open enrollment. I'm about all children in our state being prepared to have a meaningful career, go to college, or have a meaningful career.
What types of challenges would you expect if you are elected to this job?
So I think the challenge is I'm not accepting the status quo. We have to admit there needs to be a change. I haven't talked to anyone out there in our state or outside of the state that thinks 3 out of 10 children reading well enough to go to college or get a career is acceptable. Everyone is shocked, right? So I'm not going to accept the status quo. The challenge will be just in any type of change where we're going to be focused on making sure the kids are learning and making sure that the Department of Public Instruction is meeting and exceeding expectations for our customers. When I say customers or clients or people that rely on us, are our schools, our school boards, our parents, right? Like, so there is a part of DPI that needs to be responsive. And right now, like when I called DPI the other day, I had to wait 10 days before someone got back to me. That's too long. So I will make sure that we're doing an assessment of where are the areas that DPI is doing really well, and what are the areas that we need to do better so that we can provide the best service possible to our schools, school boards, and parents, all in the name of making sure our kids are learning and having the best, you know, education possible in Wisconsin. So I think anytime there's change, there's going to be some challenges.
As we're finishing up here, I just have a couple of issues that are specifically relevant. We are obviously based in Milwaukee, and so there are a lot of issues that are coming up right now for Milwaukee voters. How do you view school resource officers, their efficacy, and how to implement them best in Milwaukee?
You know, so with the SROs, that was a law again, right? Like a law that they needed to put SROs into the schools. I wasn't a part of those conversations. I'm not, you know, I don't work for the city or Milwaukee Public Schools, but that was a law. And then when you see how many calls have been made every day to help in the schools, and you could see why that came about, right? So I support, following the law. The mayor has said it, the governor has said it. Now, MPS school board too, like they, yes, let's do it, right? And so I do believe SROs need to be trained to be able to work in schools. And it can be like a really wonderful experience. Like they're trained, it's different. I already know that police already have training, but then to work in a school with children, I do think you need to have training for that. I think it's helpful. And building a relationship with not only the kids, but with the families and the school teams, it can be like a really wonderful experience, right? To have that another great relationship with an adult in your community. And so I think, the SROs can be like another champion for our kids. But I do think that they need to be trained, like, and working with children. Not that they don't already have training, but it's different working in a school with kids all day. So,
My last question is also kind of Milwaukee specific, and it's in reference to the audit that the state ordered of MPS schools. There were 29 a 29 point action plan to basically overhaul the operation of the school district. How would you oversee that action plan and make sure it gets implemented? Where would the accountability be if you were to lead DPI?
Yeah, so I think it's really important from you can see from the results for kids and then reading results and then seeing the audit, right? It is in disarray. I want to have an office in Milwaukee so that we can be supportive right away, so that we can partner with the new superintendent. She's going to need support. And then making sure that we are being very transparent about where MPS is at. And giving that information to the board and the community, and then how we're supporting them. We want the accountability, but we need to be supportive also. And so I see us, again, being a great partner to ensure more kids are able to be successful and we can get to 95%. Our kids here in Milwaukee, like, so when I've started a school on the south side and north side. They're so excited to start go little K-4s. I don't know how much time you've spent in schools, but little 4-year-olds are so excited to come to school. They're like, hi, and they're relying on adults, right? And our families here too are relying on us, on educators, to ensure that their children are being taken care of course, like safety always first and cared about. And then that we're teaching them how to read and do math so they can be successful. And so I'm looking forward to being able to work with the new superintendent in the schools and coming up with the, there are other cities that are making huge progress and we can learn from them. It's possible. I'm excited about the potential of, hopefully I get through and like really creating an amazing school district because our kids, because they deserve it. Year after year, you can see what's happening, and our community deserves an excellent, and I say our because I live right here, right? Excellent school district for our children. And we know there are other examples outside of Milwaukee to show how to do it, and we can even do it better.
Brittany Kinzer is a candidate for state superintendent. She spoke with WUWM education reporter Katherine Kokel. Also on the ballot is the woman who currently holds the job, Jill Underley. Prior to her election in 2021, Underley was the superintendent of the Pecatonica Area School District, which is southwest of Madison. She's also worked as an assistant director for the Department of Public Instruction, and she was a public school teacher and administrator. Underley joins WUWM education reporter Katherine Kokel to discuss the challenges of leading a school system in a state where the birth rate is declining and where per-student funding hasn't kept up with inflation.
Let's kick it off by talking about your priorities. What are the top 3 to 5 things you hope to address if you are reelected?
The first is going to be public school funding. We need to make sure that we have sustainable, predictable revenue in all our public schools. And that's really the main priority. The other priorities are, teacher recruitment and retention, making sure that we attract great teachers to Wisconsin and that we're able to keep them. So that's priority number two. Priority number three is probably a 5-way tie, but we need to make sure that we have mental health supports for students in our schools, and that we're supporting kids, especially after we find out, you know, through our youth risk behavior survey data that our kids are still really struggling with anxiety and depression, and food insecurity. So making sure that we have, you know, pieces in place that support kids in their educational journey. So mental health, nutrition, and other elements of belonging and inclusion.
When you said recruit and retain quality teachers, how do you plan to do that?
Yeah, so the first part is, I guess, good news. I mean, we are preparing enough teachers in Wisconsin through our UW system and our private school college partners. But the second part of that is that we're not doing enough to keep them. And there's a lot of, you know, things that kind of feed into that. The biggest finding we have is that we don't compensate our teachers as well as other states. So like in Illinois, for example, they're paying teachers 20% more than teachers in Wisconsin are earning. But another reason teachers leave, it's not just all about compensation. It's about support. As our school districts have had to reduce their budgets because they're not getting enough revenue, they've cut positions that traditionally would support teachers, support professionals like people who would do, you know, like classroom aides, recess aides, food service, playground supervision, bus supervision. I mean, there's a bunch of things that we've been cutting back on. And so teachers' working conditions have changed rather dramatically in the past 15, 20 years. So we need to address that. We also need to address, you know, mental health. We need to address partnerships, I suppose I could say, you know, between our schools and our communities, so there's more support for our public schools. So I think overall, it's what the teachers are telling us is that their working conditions need to improve as well for them to stay.
This next question I asked your opponent, and I want to throw it to you as well. How do you plan to balance the needs of public and private schools? DPI is obviously tasked with regulating public schools, licensing and regulating teachers in the public sphere. Is there space for the state superintendent of public instruction to balance the needs of public and private schools? How have you approached that in the job, and how do you plan to approach that?
So we follow the law. In the current law or statute, the Department of Public Instruction does have some regulation of private schools that are in the choice program. So like if you go to our website, for example, we do have, you know, we do administer some financial aspects. Actually, all the financial aspects that are public dollars come from DPI as like a flow through agency. We handle their audits and their financial reports. We also monitor some of their assessments that they do that are regulated by the state. So we already do some things, you know, related to the schools that are in the private school choice program. But the issue for me has always been that we are funding two systems in the state of Wisconsin. We're funding a public school system, which accepts all kids and is regulated, you know, significantly so. Like when you look at teacher licensing, when you look at school report cards, when you look at even when schools can start. And then we are also funding a private system with public dollars, and they don't have nearly the number of regulations or the accountability that public schools have. And so as the superintendent of public instruction, it's difficult to balance the fact that you have one system that accepts all kids and they are overseen by school boards that are locally elected. And then you have another system, the private choice system, which doesn't accept all kids, yet still takes public money and doesn't have the oversight of locally elected officials because they're getting those public dollars too. So it's, for me, it's a philosophical thing, but you know, it's like we have laws that we have to follow, and we definitely follow the law.
What are the challenges you see ahead if you're elected to a second term in this office, and how do you address them? How do you overcome them?
Yeah, I mean, school finance is definitely a big piece of that. And as you said, you know, the number of referendum are continually to increase. They're also larger in dollar amounts than they used to be. And some of that has to do with the fact that the private school systems are expanding and they're taking more public dollars. because we're not getting an influx of more money into the education budget as a whole. The piece of pie that goes to private school choice is just getting larger. And so you see these whopper referendum in a lot of communities, especially the urban communities, because they are, you know, millions of dollars of their operating budget is going to private school choice. In some of these rural communities, I mean, we've not been able to keep up school funding with inflation. And so you see more and more, it's like these high stakes referendums where for these rural communities, it's a non-recurring referendum that might be like a third of their operational budget. And if it fails, they have very limited options. And so we're seeing more and more, it's kind of like coming to the brink when it comes to school finance. So we need to do something. That's definitely a challenge. And one of the solutions is to stop, you know, paying for two systems.
On the student achievement front, you have been criticized for changing state standards. I wonder how you defend that decision and how you look at the future of student achievement, especially in a declining enrollment situation that we are in here.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess when I come back to this, the decision was made with the best interest of kids, right? And we need to stay focused on what's best for kids. And our tests should measure what kids are actually learning in our schools. And it should not be tied to national politics. And changing the cut scores to reflect what kids were learning on the Wisconsin test and not reflect what they're learning on a different test is just good policy. And that helps teachers understand, you know, what they need to be teaching, where kids are in their educational journey, where they need more support, where they need to be more challenged. And it was also good policy, like I said, initially for students and for families too, to understand how their students are doing. I guess the side of it that, you know, that support, that's saying that standards were lower. I mean, they're absolutely wrong. I mean, that's two different things, right? There's the standards that kids are tested on, and then there's the cut scores or the bands or the grading scale, as you want to call it. That determines where they're at. And by adjusting that grading scale, we made sure that we were understanding where kids were actually performing on the standards, which we, you know, are, they're challenging. We do, of course, you know, going forward, you know, we bring in new standards, we take out old ones. We did add a literacy score for each child on their forward test so that they understand and their parents understand and their teachers understand where they're performing in literacy as compared to other kids in the district, which I think is really helpful. So, I mean, we just have to keep our eye on it. We always have to make sure our standards are high and that our kids are being challenged because that's how you grow. But we also need to make sure that the test that they're taking is assessed fairly, so that we can understand where they are and where they need additional support.
I wanted to kind of finish up by talking about some Milwaukee specific issues. The state released an operational audit of the district last month with this 29-point overhaul action plan. Where's the accountability if you are the head of DPI? I mean, how do you ensure that this action plan gets in place at MPS?
Yeah, so we have a corrective action plan with them, and we do have some sticks, I suppose, if you want to look at the carrot stick kind of model, and we've been using them. I've been the only state superintendent in a long time that has held Milwaukee accountable for some of these issues. And the way that we're able to do it is, you know, through corrective action plans. We meet with them so frequently. At one point, we were meeting with them daily, but I think we're meeting with them now 3 times a week. To go over different corrective action items. And one of the things is if they don't, you know, complete the things that they're supposed to do, we can withhold money from them. And we try to do so in a way that doesn't directly impact kids. It might be, you know, funding that they would get that would be something that they would be able to pay off later. For example, if like we withheld special education money, we would do it at a certain time of year. So it wouldn't directly impact kids at that moment, but we've been very successful with that. So, you know, by, you know, threatening to withhold the money, does seem to speed things up. But I think the piece of it that I think people need to understand is that this is a school district that has been underfunded for decades, and the workload that they have for their employees is incredibly intense. And there's a high level of expertise, the amount of reporting that they have to do. And their office, their business office, was understaffed, which put an additional burden on their employees. And so they were really behind. And we've been helping them out by just providing more support for them. We've been training employees for them, providing trainings, I should say. So, you know, there's ways that we are helping them. I mean, we don't want to be a punitive agency. Our job has always been to support our school districts. And when we look at the future of Wisconsin, I mean, our future depends on strong public schools.
Jill Underly is Wisconsin's state superintendent and is running for a second term. She spoke with WUWM's education reporter, Catherine Kokel. Voters will decide between Underly and education consultant Brittany Kinzer in the April 1st election. You can find more information about both candidates in our voter guide at WUWM.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Did you know the largest collection of glass paperweights is in Wisconsin? Or that Wisconsin has one of the only condiment-centered museums in the country? We'll tell you about some of Wisconsin's most unusual museums in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll explore a list of some of Milwaukee's best restaurants, according to Milwaukee Magazine. That's coming up next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine features a list of 25 of the best restaurants in the city. Dining editor Ann Christensen highlights standout dishes and shares how she narrowed down her top picks with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez.
Well, Ann, there is a lot to dig into in your latest feature for Milwaukee Magazine. But I want to start by talking about the cover of this issue. It's a gorgeous picture of different menu items at room service. How did you decide to have this restaurant be the cover?
It's a process. When I'm doing a story, any kind of feature, dining feature, I always sit down with our art director, my two editors, and we just kind of talk about because I'm the one who's out going to these places, we decide, well, do we want to have a food photo on the cover, or do we want to show a restaurant, or do we want to show a person eating? You know what I mean? We kind of make these decisions. But going into this story, I thought, we've got to show room service. I don't know that I necessarily thought in that planning stage that it would be the cover photo, but I envisioned it as the first photo you would see when you opened up the feature, which didn't end up being the case. And that's partly because it ended up on the cover. So we didn't want to duplicate that. Although the photo is used again in the feature, but it is such a striking looking restaurant and the food is so beautifully presented. I mean, seeing it just makes you want to go there.
Yeah, well, I think it works great. I do want to talk more about the 25 restaurants that you feature this year in your list, including some new restaurants like Room Service that we just talked about. But what's another new place that rises at the top of your list?
I mean, I'd love to mention more than one, but Margot Brasserie in Brookfield, which, you know, I don't know of a lot of restaurants that aren't chain restaurants that you want to go to that are in like a outdoor mall type setting. I mean, it's a little unusual. But this restaurant is just really great and it's really unexpected. It is a French restaurant and it is owned by the same person who owns the Bel Air Cantina Mexican restaurants. This is really different for the owner, actually. It's a very different type of restaurant. And it definitely has a sort of French bistro menu. So there's a lot of traditional things like bouillabaisse and French onion soup. And they have a croque margot, which is like a French ham and cheese sandwich with a Mornay sauce and an egg on top, really. And they have a great burger and they have fries. So it's actually, it can be, you know, a fancy experience where you're having like a night out, or it can be just a really great lunch. So I love seeing restaurants like this open, and I have a personal love for French food. So this one really, really appeals to me.
I love that. Yeah. I think one that stood out to me was Himalayan Yak. I think the name caught my eye. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So this restaurant is in Bayview, and it actually sort of reflects a trend that's going on in Milwaukee, or has been going on for probably the last maybe 5 to 7 years, which is sort of this trickling in of dishes from the Himalayan region. So Nepal, and that cuisine actually is influenced a lot by the countries around it. So it's very much influenced by North India. So some of the dishes will really remind you of Indian food. And when you go to a Himalayan restaurant, there often might be Indian food available as well. So I've been seeing this trend happening, and I've been seeing momo, which are Himalayan dumplings. I've been seeing those just kind of here and there. This place, Himalayan Yak, is like the first, it's less of a hybrid model, and there's more Himalayan cuisine than I've seen elsewhere, I guess you could say. I mean, the food is just really good. I love immigrant food, and I just love having this type of cuisine in Milwaukee. It's really comforting. It's homey. It's satisfying. And I think it's actually really beautiful, too.
Absolutely. Well, I'm curious, too, Anne, from the editor's letter, I understand that remaining anonymous when you go to review any restaurant is important to your craft.
It is true. Yeah.
Can you talk about why that is and how long you've been doing this for?
Yeah, I think people don't really know why. And there's a lot of critics out there that are not doing that anymore. But what I have always stood by from day one, and I've been doing this since the late 90s, was I want to go to a restaurant and have the experience that everybody else has, any diner has. If I go in and they know that I'm going to be writing about them, there is always going to be the potential that they could, you know, try to give me free things. I can't accept anything for free. Anything that would suggest that they're currying favor, that somehow I would write something positive about them in exchange for this fabulous meal. So there's this ethical line that gets crossed, in my opinion, if you are going into a restaurant and they know that you are a dining critic. So to me, it's just so important. It's so important to just, you know, be this person that is kind of representing just the general public, getting the kind of experience that anyone can get, you know?
Absolutely. Well, something else that I noticed when reading through the feature is the fun you had with it. I loved looking through your approval matrix. You had some like hot takes and some fun, fresh takes. Like the hot take that stood out to me was fried chicken sandwiches are out, or what's in is casual dining pop-ups and fine dining restaurants. I wonder what inspired this section?
Well, first of all, I can't take credit for the concept of an approval matrix. The actual concept of an approval matrix is something that I've seen in New York Magazine. They've been doing it for many, many years. And I was thinking about it and I thought, I really want to do something like this for Milwaukee. So that was where this whole idea came from. And then the more I kind of jumped into it, I was like, oh, this could get really fun here. I really like this. This is really working. So, but yeah, like you mentioned the chicken sandwiches. That is me saying, okay, I mean, I like a fried chicken sandwich. I have no problem with them. They're great. I'm just feeling like, oh my God, we've kind of reached the saturation point of fried chicken sandwiches. It's funny. So yeah, I was just thinking about, kind of what the trends are right now here in Milwaukee dining and even larger trends and how they're reflected here. And then there's just little things like schnitzel. In German restaurants, these are really popular. It's basically a fried breaded cutlet, usually pork, could be veal, sometimes chicken. This is a trend, though. I'm seeing a lot of them. I'm seeing restaurants do schnitzel versions that are vegetarian using a mushroom. And I've been going to a lot of Asian restaurants, and the Japanese dish katsudon, which is basically a rice bowl with a panko crusted fried pork cutlet and an egg on top. That fried pork cutlet, that katsu, is essentially another version of a schnitzel. And I'm just seeing a ton of this. So I wanted to, I don't know, kind of do something fun with these things that I see and that maybe other people don't because they're not looking at the dining scene like I am all the time, which is with a microscope of essentially,
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was really fun.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
Well, in addition to 2025's best new restaurants, you do highlight some classics. How did you narrow down these picks as restaurants worth revisiting again? And what's one that stands out to you?
Well, it's both difficult and then it's not. In Milwaukee, we have the, I don't know, I guess you could call it the gift of having a coterie of restaurants that just maintain their excellence year after year. That is something that I have seen in Milwaukee for a very long time. So places like Sanford and Odd Duck and Good Kind and Lake Park Bistro, Ristorante Bartolotta, The Diplomat. I mean, these places, they're knocking it out of the park year after year. So those types of restaurants, I always know that, okay, I'm going to revisit these places and just make sure, they're still up at that excellent level. But I think it's fantastic that we have such a healthy and consistently fantastic top restaurant list. That also doesn't mean that, a restaurant will not drop out, because they definitely will, or a new restaurant will come on. So I'm just going to mention one place that I brought back to the list, which I didn't have last year, because I did the same story last year, but I brought it back because I was like, oh my God, this place is great. And I don't know if something happened between the last couple of years, but I feel like they're better than they've ever been. And that is Sorella, which is in Bayview. It is an Italian restaurant. So the owners are, both of them are originally from New Jersey, and they're both from Italian American families. So it has kind of their own personal nostalgia about what Italian American food is. And then it also kind of draws on the chef's experience as a pizzaiolo. So he was the chef at a restaurant that a lot of people will know. It was called Wolf Peach. It's no longer, but the pizzas there were kind of in the style of Neapolitan. They were fantastic. So they do those Neapolitan style pizzas at Sorella, and they have incredible entrees like ossobuco. The pastas are fantastic. It's just an all around really excellent restaurant, which I was happy to bring back to the list. So what I do when I start doing a story like this is I really just start ramping up going to revisit restaurants. I mean, I just start doing that months in advance. And it might even mean returning. It might mean more than one visit. And it also means trying to have my finger on the pulse of what's happening all the time. So there isn't like a science to this list. It's very, I would say it's almost like emotional in a way, because these restaurants are, like I said, a lot of them are really consistently great. And then you have these other ones that just kind of squeak in there, and you're like, oh my gosh, they just got really amazing. They have to be on this list. So yeah, it's an interesting process, I have to say, to do a story like this.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for speaking with me today. And I'm really excited to check out some of your picks.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Anne Christensen is the dining editor at Milwaukee Magazine. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. You can find Christensen's Best Restaurants feature in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll share some of Wisconsin's most unique museums and what you can see there. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsin is known for a lot of things. It's dairy, it's beer, and it's oddities. The state is home to many unique places, including a wide variety of weird museums. T. Krulos wrote about some of them for Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins me to share just a few of the unique museums you can find here in Wisconsin. So there are many odd museums in the state of Wisconsin. In fact, a number that could not be included on this list because, you know, you only have so much space on the page, as it were.
Right.
But you have a great list of some interesting museums. I'm going to start with one that really caught my eye. It's also what the list starts with, the National Mustard Museum.
I know. It's a very odd place. I mean, all these places are great because they're so unique. And like you say, Wisconsin is very rich with them. So I had no trouble finding stuff to write about. But yeah, the Mustard Museum is just outside of Madison, and it has over 6,000 mustard bottles and related items. One of the best parts of it, though, is they have a gift shop that is also a tasting room. So you can sample over 100 different types of mustards. So if you love mustards, this is a must stop on your list.
I feel like mustard is one of those things that you go, well, how many kinds of mustard can there be? And then you look in your refrigerator and you go, I
sure
have 6 kinds of mustard in this refrigerator.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of the few condiment museums in the country. The other one would be out, Heinz, you know, has a pretty good museum. But
sure.
So if you like ketchup and mustard, that might be your epic road trip there.
So the next one we're going to look at, this is about a history that I think some Wisconsinites are familiar with and then others are surprised to learn about. This is the History Museum at the Castle, and it looks at Houdini.
I know, it's such a great story, and I, like you say, I don't think it's recognized enough. I mean, we have the bronze fawns, which is great, but Houdini was actually an amazing person who spent his formative years living in Appleton first. He lived there for about 4 years. And then they actually lived in Milwaukee for a while before they moved on to New York. So the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton has this great exhibit called AKA Houdini, in which you kind of journey through his life, and they have some really fun interactive displays where you can kind of try out some of his escape tricks and magic tricks. And it's just a really nice recognition of this famous resident of Appleton.
Yeah. Now, the next museum I think is going to be very interesting for polka lovers. And when I was thinking about like an accordion museum, this is an accordion museum, I wondered what that would look like. And then I went, oh, well, they're a complex instrument.
Yes. Yeah, not surprising that this would be in Wisconsin, way up in Superior, Wisconsin. They have this huge collection of over 2,500 accordions. And like you say, most people associate that with polka, and that's certainly a key part of that genre. But they have accordions from all over the world because they are used in different music styles. And the museum there is really great because it's in an old church. And so they have the museum display. They also have a venue where they, of course, have accordion-centric performances. And they have a repair shop and a really big archive of sheet music and other stuff related to accordions. So it's really an important cultural part of the state.
And that's called a world of accordions,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Well, and speaking of the world, the next museum we'll be looking at, I think some people, again, are going to know bits of this history. A lot of different towns have kind of a circus clown history here in Wisconsin. But this is the International Clown Hall of Fame and Research Center.
Yes. So this location, by the way, has moved around a little bit. I remember back in the day, it was in like the basement level of the Plankinton building, which is also where the WUWM studios were at the time. So you were neighbors with this at one point. And Baraboo has such a rich history of the circus. The Ringling brothers were from Baraboo, and it became like a circus capital of the country for a while. A lot of circuses had their headquarters there. So it's a good spot for the International Clown Hall of Fame, where they have pictures of famous clowns as well as their rubber noses and giant shoes and costumes and props that they used. Like I noted in this article, might not be a great place for some people to go because some people do have a pretty intense fear of clowns. I don't. I mean, once in a while I find them kind of creepy, but I think I have a normal level of reaction to them.
I will say my arch nemesis is the probably still more famous Joy Powers, who is a clown.
Really?
Joy Powers the clown, yes.
Do you think that she is in the International Clown Hall of Fame?
Look, she might be. She was very well known. Anytime I would Google my name, Joy Powers the clown came up right away.
Oh, that's too funny.
So the final museum that we're going to talk about, this is the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass. I've heard this is just a beautiful museum.
It is. It is very beautiful. I mean, there's so much glass in it. And then when the light comes through the right way, you know, it's really quite dazzling. And it's home to the largest collection of glass paperweights in the world, which is over 6,000 pieces. So it's a lot of glass. I mean, it does make me, being a bigger guy, it makes me a little nervous in places like this because I'm afraid I'm going to break something. But yeah, very beautiful individual pieces of glasswork there.
Now, of course, like with any list, you couldn't include every museum. But what were some of your favorite museums that didn't make the cut?
Well, one I really wanted to include was the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in Hayward, which is kind of famous because the museum is shaped like a giant muskie that you can walk into and see fishing artifacts. However, they're only open seasonally, so you can go visit there this summer. But, you know, this being a winter issue, I wanted to include places that people could go out and visit right away. So that was one. And then Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum. I know you've had them on the show before. I wrote about them last year, which is why I didn't include them. But they have a overwhelming collection of cat knickknacks. Again, I was a little nervous because there's so many fragile pieces. But, you know, and the good thing about them is it's for a good cause. The money that they raise, they give to cat shelters and stuff like that. Oh, and then last one I think I'll mention, I was just in Lake Geneva. We talked a little bit about that before we went on the air, and I went to the Geneva Lake Museum, which is a cool little museum. I love that they have kind of their own take on, like, streets of old Milwaukee when you first walk in. And they've got a nice little display called The Wizard of Lake Geneva, which is about Dungeons and Dragons, which came from there, and this year is their 50th anniversary. So that was something I just checked out a couple days ago and wasn't on my list, but it is now.
All right. Well, T, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
T. Krulos is a local writer. We spoke last year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. CCAP is an online service where people can access information about court cases. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll explore how that information is used. Plus, as we get ready for March Madness, we'll explore sports gambling laws in the state. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.